Ultra Running Magazine. You know, it's the invisible glue that binds our community together.
You know, I you're absolutely right, Don. I'm laughing, but I'm laughing because it's true.
And I surprised you with what I was going to say. You had no idea.
You did, and you kind of made a face when you said it. You know, I just got my November issue.
Right, me too.
Do you know what's on the cover?
It's wrapped in plastic, because it should be. Because if you're not a member of this community, you shouldn't be thumbing your fingers through it. That's why it's wrapped.
It's to keep the riffraff out?
It's to keep the roadrunners out.
The November issue has a cover of a, you know, I don't even know who it is. And
Scott.
People probably going, Scott, come on, you don't know who that is? Well, it's a runner. That's all I know. It's a runner running a race, and he's holding, it looks like, his son. I'm making assumptions.
Right.
And they're looking in each other's eyes, and I can see a communication from the father to the son saying, you know what, you can do hard things in this life.
Yeah.
That's what I got out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome, and that's part of the invisible glue that I'm talking about. It is what binds us.
And the cover's not the best part, Mr. Freeman.
Yeah, well, tell me.
You know, there's lots of stuff in there. They have done a really, really good job of breaking it up and making themes. They have regular contributors. You know, Ann Trayson is a regular contributor. Ellie Greenwood is a regular. Joe Juhan, who we just interviewed, is a regular contributor. One that's coming up, Gary Dudney, is a regular contributor. Matt Lay, we've had him on here before.
Right.
Maybe we work for Ultra Running Magazine. I don't know. Maybe we do.
Maybe we're not coming up with these guests at all. Maybe we're just thumbing through the pages.
Maybe they need to sue us for plagiarism.
They may.
I don't know.
No, we asked them if we could do it, and they said it's fine.
Anyway, you should not go another month without one. If you don't have a subscription, get a subscription. Go to trailrunnernation.com. Click on the partners page. Click on the subscribe. You get $20 off a subscription. It goes to $29.95 for a full year subscription to Ultra Running Magazine. You'd be silly. You would be in a state of a bonk if you didn't go and get yourself a subscription. This episode is brought to you in part by HelloFresh.
HelloFresh.com.
HelloFresh, we came across. It is a meal in a box.
But just not any meal, Scott. Good food in a box.
Good food. They were kind enough to send Don and I a meal plan. It had three meals. It's a subscription meal plan. And in each of those boxes, they have really fresh ingredients measured to the exact quantities with a recipe that you should be able to, from start to finish, make a real healthy meal in less than 30 minutes.
And it's food that you otherwise wouldn't make on your own. There's just fun and exciting entrees that show up, and you can put it together.
And you know what? When we ate, my wife and I ate ours, you know, we were planning to go out to dinner.
Mm.
And I said, you know what? Let's not go out to dinner. Let's eat this. Let's prepare and eat this. So we got together, and we both opened the box, and we prepared the meal, and ate it. It was a great, great fun because we got to talk about the day and had a great meal. Seemed very, very healthy, and all for a very reasonable price.
My daughter and I did the exact same thing. She was excited to put this box and create a meal out of it. And one of the additional benefits is she's learning how to cook, and she's learning how to make meals she wouldn't otherwise have made.
Now, HelloFresh has made a really good deal for Trail Runner Nation members. You can get on a meal plan. If you go to HelloFresh.com, you can look at their classic plan, their veggie plan. They have a family plan also. It roughly comes out to being cheaper than going to just a fast food restaurant.
Oh, sure. And the meal's so much better for you because it is healthy food. And we work hard out there on the trail. We need to replenish ourselves with good food because, as the old saying is, we are what we eat. And
garbage in, garbage out, right, Don? So go to HelloFresh.com. You can look at their meal plans. You can order 3, 4, or 5 different meals per week designed for either 2 or 4 people, and they're adding recipes every week.
Awesome. You can get $35 off your first week of deliveries. Visit HelloFresh.com and enter the code TRN when you subscribe.
That's HelloFresh.com.
You know what that is, Scott? It's not an aid station. It is the sound you hear when you open up the door at Trail Runner Nation store.
That's hilarious.
Well, not really, but
hey, we're excited. We have the new Trail Runner Nation buffs and sleeves, which have been on there for a while. They're awesome, by the way. We're getting great reviews.
Yeah.
I love them personally. But we are opening the door. And this week, we will be adding our fall T-shirts and hoodies. If you had a chance to participate in that hoodie and T-shirt offer last fall, it's the same type of shirt, same type of hoodie.
Because they're so awesome.
Different colors, and they're really cool. The T-shirts are going to go for $19, hoodies for $40. Great holiday gift, so go check them out.
That's on our website, trailrunnernation.com. Go enter the store.
Click the store, and you may hear a cowbell.
That's an aid station bell, Scott.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra-running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
The problem with the message above is that it flies in the face of what we know to be true.
We'll Candace, we are such idiots. You don't even you have no idea.
Yeah. I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything.
That's how most podcast or runs start,
yeah,
right?
Is yeah.
Exactly, that's right.
You throw out a topic and you just start talking, even though you don't know what you're talking about.
So
absolutely.
So we show up at the trailhead, right? And all of a sudden, Gary's climbing out of his car, and we see him. We go, let's run with Gary.
I recognize that guy.
Yeah,
he has a big beard. Red beard.
Yeah,
I've seen him.
So let's
and then we just start running and talking physics.
Yeah. And what do you know about physics, Gary?
Absolutely nothing. But it's nothing we can't figure out in a couple of hours on a long run, right?
On a long run. By the time we come back, we'll have a PhD. We'll be physicists. Yeah.
Isn't that how that works?
That's
how physics was discovered, on a long run.
How much stuff is passed along on that trail that you accept as gospel at some point? You go, you know, he doesn't. The moon is made of cheese.
I don't even have cable, so all of my news comes straight from the mouth of other runners.
Oh, you're in trouble.
So it is. It's just gospel. That's it. That's how I disseminate all my news around what's going on in the world.
Hey, after mile 12, start only believing half of what you hear. Hey, so you've done a lot of amazing things. Let's get a little background about Gary.
Well, all I know is our good friend Candace Burt, mm-hmm. who I think she has a love affair with Hurt 100 Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we first heard about you from her. You've won Hurt once, I think, and finished second.
Three times?
You finished three times.
I've won it three times and finished second once.
Yeah, see, that's the kind of research we do here at Trail Runner Nation.
I mean, these are difficult things to research, so I wouldn't expect you to know that.
I only recognized him when he got out of his car because he had a red beard. That's it.
Where would you find that information? Even if you wanted to find it, where would you find it?
It would be like we need to invent an internet or something to do this. I don't know. Maybe one day.
Maybe a search bar, maybe some queries. And
it's probably going to be like a Yahoo email group or something.
Hey, when we get back off this run, let's start working on that. I know a few guys we can contact that can help move this idea down the road.
Well, part of the physics thing is there's a time component in physics.
Yeah.
And I just didn't have time. Or didn't make time. There we go.
So tell us, give us a little information about Barclays Marathon. You have a little experience there as well, too, right?
Yes, I did. I lined up for the Barclays Marathons in April of this year and had the great pleasure of learning very rapidly what a beast of a race that is lines up to be.
It's different than any other race out there, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. It's so intriguing because if you were to drive past Frozen Head State Park on the highway, you can see the mountains from outside the park, and I wouldn't even call them mountains. They kind of look like molehills, and you would never fathom that a race of that magnitude could exist on that terrain. It just doesn't add up from first glance. You would drive past Frozen Head without blinking.
Yeah, we have all these great mountain ranges that we look at and mountains that touch the clouds and then beyond. But driving by something with just molehills, you think, how hard can that be?
Yeah, exactly. So they've managed to definitely build out one of the hardest events in the world, and it only takes a couple of minutes on the course to really come to terms with what it actually is.
Tell us your experience about finding out how to register, registering, and finally getting the letter.
I don't think I'm allowed to answer any of those questions.
Okay, well
you've been sworn.
Hey, what's set on the run, Gary? What's set on the run stays on the run. You know
it's
that.
Just between you, me, Don, and
some other
just
headphones.
Just us and the greater physics community that is tuned in to learn about their profession right now.
Tell us what you can tell us. Without...
So, yeah. It's definitely it's an interesting process. So they had the documentary that went to Netflix this year, which really changed everything. It gave people insight into what the race is, and it went from being one of the most obscure races just over a year ago to one of the most infamous or famous races out there right now. But the registration process is you basically have to learn how to message the race director at a specific minute on a specific day, and you have to submit an essay as to why you should be allowed to run the Barkley Marathons. And then Lazarus Lake, the race director, Gary Cantrell, his birth name, picks 40 people that get to line up for the race. And to the best of my guess is that they're seeing hundreds, if not over 1,000 applications. There's no actual numbers on this. They don't publish any of that. And when they select their 40 runners, they don't tell, they don't publish, they don't show who they are. It's up to the individual to then tell people if they are one of those runners. So you have no idea who's actually going to be at the race.
Wow.
And you get a letter of condolences as your acceptance, which basically says, get your affairs in order. What the heck are you thinking? You've got no chance in hell at this. And make sure that you've got a will for your next of kin.
does the letter that you write explaining why you should run, does it have to be nonfiction? And I guess I don't want to get into your ability to write or the prose that you used, but give us a snippet of why you thought you should run Barclays.
Hypothetical, allegedly, if you were to coach someone, maybe not yourself, what do you think might
and does
get
it have
Laz's
to, does
attention?
It, does it have to deal with beard hygiene trade secrets with Lazarus? sharing.
That's your starting point. Absolutely, your starting point. I also recognize that his birth name is Gary, and he's never had a Gary finisher, so I definitely managed to work that into
nice. Good. Well done.
There you go, yeah. And there's also, there's a history at that race where the finishers, they're usually quite intelligent people, usually master's PhD style intelligence. And I've got none of that, but so that was also something I worked into there was I go against a little bit of the grain of the finishers that they've had. And I mentioned of that, I graduated high school, dropped out of university. So I don't have the PhD that a lot of those guys have, but I was told that there's definitely some weight given to results. So as much as I didn't really intend to include any of that, I put it in there for just so that there was the context. And the big thing I was trying to communicate, though, was, you know, everybody knows the Barkley now. And just over a year ago, the Netflix, I think it was for purchase. It came out about exactly a year ago in November. I think it went to the documentary went to Netflix itself in like January. Everybody knows the Barkley, but I've known about the Barkley for almost 10 years. I've been wanting to apply for almost as long. And I would have applied back in 2012, 2010, but I was intending to apply that year and I was having a very good race year, but I broke my foot twice and ended up on crutches for 8.5 months and I didn't end up applying. So my application was very much about establishing that I have known this race for a long time. I've been following it for a long time. I've done my due diligence and my research as to what it is. And I certainly was aware of what I was getting into and was not willing to apply until I was 100% applying myself to that being my only real race goal for the year. And, so that was basically what my essay consisted of, just saying that I was all in, and it took me many years to get to that point. And thankfully, so I wasn't actually selected as one of the initial 40. They do a wait list after that. One fun thing with the Barkley is, again, most of the people associated with it are very intelligent, including Laz, who is uber smart. They like to play on words as much as they can. So any word that can be spelled as a different meaning is. So the wait list is spelled weight as in body weight. anything else they can spell incorrectly, they do. So the wait list gets released, and that is another 40 names. And when the wait list is the only thing that's made public. So the initial 40 are not made public, but if you're on the wait list, people know that your name is on there. And I was number 8. And I was told right off the bat that it's never not gone double digit deep. So I pretty much knew as soon as they did the draw that I would be lining up for the Barclay at Frozen Head State Park.
Hey, what do you think that Netflix is going to do for Barclay? Is it going to change the community and the culture and what we have learned to appreciate the race Barclay?
That's a valid question. And from what I've seen, having only been there once and only been there since the documentary, but I've talked with Jared about this, and certainly the presence this year, the media presence was higher than it has been. But Jared said, and you know, when they were shooting the documentary, that was shot in 2012. There was still a bunch of media there at that point as well. And as you do a bit more research, talk to a few more people, the race was in jeopardy of not happening for a bit, and Frozen Head State Park itself was in jeopardy of not getting funding as a park. So there's a fine balance that has to be met with the race director and the race to generate interest in the park and user visits and financials to keep the park open while also not compromising the integrity of the race, which goes against the grain of having media on site. But one of the great things with the race is that media aren't allowed on course. So they can only really be in the campground. And Laz does a great job of just stating right off the top that you're welcome to film anything from a distance. But if you want to interview people or step on their campsite, you just have to ask them. And if they say no, then you have to respect that. And I found overwhelmingly that all the media were very respectful, and I didn't feel like there was too much on site for what it was.
Now, there's a greater chance that I would run the Kentucky Derby before I would run Barclay Marathons. And no matter how many Netflix specials come out, it convinces me even more that I'm not qualified to do that. I don't want any part of that. And I don't mind going out and running long and deep into the night and multiple day. Any of that stuff is good. But not knowing where I am and searching for books with pages and coming back more...
And what are those thorns called out there?
Yeah. I don't want any part of that.
Yeah.
And then the water. The water is, they're frozen jugs of water. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, right from the application process on out through the race, everything about it is unique, and everything about it is basically set up to give you every opportunity to fail and quit as possible. Wow. And, you know, Laz has this great quote where, you know, if you're meant to be there, you'll find a way. And the whole application and everything is a great way of weeding out those who shouldn't be there to begin with. Yeah. But, that's part of the challenge, definitely, of the race, is that there's no flagging. There's books hidden in the forest. You've got to navigate on your own. You're up for 2.5 days without sleeping. And I found the biggest challenge to be that you don't know when the race is going to begin. He blows a conch and you get a 1-hour warning. And that happens anytime between 11 p.m. on Friday and 11 a.m. on Saturday. And I was convinced, because 1 year prior, they started very late the next day, the next morning, that they would start early, as in closer to midnight on Friday. So I was laying down at 6 o'clock waiting to get up, and I didn't sleep all night long. And by the time they blew the conch the next morning at 9:30, I had already pretty much been awake for 27 hours before the race even began.
Man, wow. Let's talk about the camaraderie that's out there, because it's dangerous out there, and usually when those circumstances are in place, people bind themselves together and link arms to make sure that they can pull through. What was your experience with that?
You could not be more right in what you just said, and definitely that's what happens at the Barclay, is it ends up being packs of runners, and there aren't many individuals because the terrain is so complex. It's so easy to make mistakes and get lost and not know where you are. So my experience was that I went out with the lead pack, that being Jared Campbell and about 6 other people for a total of about 8, and I was just hanging with that group as people peeled away one at a time. And after the first lap, the first, they call it 20, but as we know, it's at 26 or more. after we came in, after the first lap, there were 3 of us that arrived together in camp, and then only myself and Jared departed together for the second lap. And Jared and I knew of each other. We had a phone conversation. He was kind enough to allow me to call him once I realized I was going to get into the race to just ask some questions. And he basically said, listen, my advice is this. Go to the Barclay. Do the first 2 laps taking as little stress as possible. Follow someone that knows what they're doing, and that'll set you up for your best race. But we never discussed running together because we didn't know how our paces would break down. So after a lap together and Jared and I heading out on our own on the second, we really started to connect and bond and forged quite the friendship over 47 hours of being out there together, to the point of where we're planning like an adventure outside of Barkley together. And at the end of this month in North Vancouver, where I live, Jared is flying up and we're actually doing a film night for the Barkley Marathons here in town. And his wife and one of his daughters is coming up, and we're really looking forward to the families getting to spend time together.
Oh, that's fantastic. And 47 hours on the trail out there is equivalent to 47
years.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you learn people, you learn who they are, the fabric, the very fabric of the person.
The walls have been broken down.
Yeah, when you're under that much duress. My son just stepped into the room, so if you hear some goo goo gaga, that's not my stomach. Yeah. So yeah, you definitely, under that much duress, you really get to see who a person is. And Jared and I found that we had a lot in common and really enjoyed spending that time together as much as you could on the circumstances.
Yeah.
But I think one of the traits or characteristics that we recognized in each other was, in 47 hours of being out there on the Barkley together, not once did either of us ask the very simple question of how are you doing or how are you feeling? Because it's such an asinine question in that moment where it's the worst thing to be asked. And we both understood that. And it was just this unwritten rule where talk about anything else. And we did. And that just it furthered the bond that we developed by recognizing what to and not to talk about out there.
Hey, how important was it for you to be with somebody that had already run the race? Do you think that you could have gone out there with your compass and your map and
impossible.
Found a way?
Absolutely impossible. So there's a reason why the average Barkley finisher took 5 or 6 years to get to the finish. That's the standard, like that's the time investment that most of those finishers had to put in. And it is not based on, I mean, it's based on so many variables, but more than anything else, it's the navigating of the course. And orienteers who show up even say, you know, this is not an orienteering course. Certainly map and compass skills are vital, but it's not like an orienteering race where your checkpoint is exactly at the point that it's supposed to be. And you need to read the description of how the book has been hidden under a rock, in a well, between trees. I mean, there was one year that he had a book under a 30-pound rock, and some of the females that showed up couldn't move the rock and had to wait for someone else to come assist them to get the book. So it goes beyond just the navigation side of things. But realistically, I would have had zero chance in hell of even coming close to getting to the fifth lap, like I ultimately did, if not for Jared's assistance in showing me how everything unfolded. And you saw that throughout. Virgin runners, first-time runners, pair up with veterans, and those who try to go without and try to just navigate fail miserably.
If all of this sounds crazy to you and you're not familiar with this race, definitely go to Netflix and watch this, because many of these things that we're talking about may seem like odd references, but when you watch it, it really will bring all of these points together, and it's an exciting event and very, very unique.
Absolutely, yeah, from start to finish.
Yeah.
I think I know the answer to this question, but because I know the trail running community and how generous they are, but are there invitees to the Barkley Marathons that are veterans that don't want to have somebody tag along, a virgin tag along? They just want to go out there and do their own thing? Or
absolutely.
Do you find that most people are giving?
No, nobody's slowing down to let anybody else go with them. Jared is not going to slow down to let me go with him. He went out as hard as he could to drop people, and that's what everybody is doing. Everybody's still competing. So the big thing is, once you establish that the person you're with can hold pace, then you work together. But there's not a single person out there who's going, oh, okay, this virgin is starting to fall off the back and I'm going to wait for them now. The entire first lap was about us, they call it scraping, was about us scraping people and just watching people fall off the back. And what I saw within the first 2 hours was, as soon as there was an opportunity to put in a push to drop another person, the push happened without fail. So wow. You would collect a book, you would climb 2,500 feet in a mile and a half, and then you would hit a trail where you could run for 5 minutes. And instantly, when you hit that trail, they were running because they knew they had a gap on the one person in the pack, and the pack needed to be thinned.
Wow. So scraping is, and forgive me for being ignorant on this, is that a pretty typical term that's used out there, or unique to Barkley, or
I think it's unique to Barkley. I've never really heard it with that referenced in that otherwise. So yeah, it's unique to Barkley, to the best of my knowledge. So you try to, they say that there's not a veteran worth his weight that isn't trying to scrape a virgin at all times.
So yeah, like anything, there's a lot of parallels in life with trail running. let's talk a little bit about and whether it relates to Barkley or not, just trail running in general. About that point of not speaking and saying negative things out there.
Yeah.
It's understood that it's hard. It's understood that it's hot. Well, I'm thirsty too, but it isn't part of the dialogue. Let's just kind of throw that around as a topic for a discussion. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think that's something that you learn over time, is there's nothing to be gained by giving a voice to your suffering, to your misery. It only makes it worse to broach it. So the more that you can ignore and compartmentalize and go without mentioning it, the better off that you'll be. And I've always, you know, said kind of fake it till you make it a lot, going into an aid station in a race and feeling like death. If you show up feeling like death and saying as much, you're going to get nothing but sympathy from people who want to help you. But if you go in and you feel like you want to drop out of the race, but you actually go in and celebrate a little bit, then you get celebration coming back at you. People are excited to see you. They're clapping and high-fiving and hooting and hollering. And you take that and you wear that when you leave. And there's not a single time that I've ever pretended to be feeling great when I'm not in a race at an aid station that I haven't then, by default, felt great while leaving that aid station because of the energy that's been reciprocated.
Yeah, absolutely. It does go and it bounces back at you, whatever you give. And there are other ways to communicate that you need some water. There's nothing wrong with it, and this is just, you know, my opinion. If you need something, it's okay to say, you know, next time we come across a stream or something, I need to get some water here. That's not complaining. That's just speaking about items that you need to sustain yourself to keep this event positive. But I've noticed that when people do end up being complainers, that we do scrape them off our local invites for runs. You know, the complainers are going to get the email or the text that, hey, we're meeting tomorrow.
In life.
Yeah.
You got to scrape those people out of your
life. Scrape the negativity. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely.
And one of the things that I just really love about the trail running community is there is that great filter of scraping the negative people and people that are pessimists and that are always walking around with a cloud over their head. The trail says you're just not welcome, because it takes a positive person to go out there and play on the trails for 12 plus hours or six.
Absolutely, yeah. It's definitely an amazing scene that we're a part of in this world, and by and large, the people in it are incredible and a lot of just a joy to be around.
Yeah, I think that's what makes the community attractive for those of us that haven't been scraped.
Maybe I have been scraped. Maybe I haven't admitted that yet.
When's the last time we ran?
How many runs have you been on this month?
That's right. I do a lot of solo running these days.
I better do some soul searching tonight. Hey, Gary. First of all, Gary is not only a great runner, sounds like a great person, but he's also a coach, and he has a great website and a blog, GaryRobbinsRun.com. And there was one video that I saw on there that talked about your 10 essentials for safe backcountry adventures, trail runner style.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to talk about that a little bit and maybe have you pick out some of the key things that you think that most runners forget or omit from their pack that you think are essential for going out on the long run.
And Gary, if I may interrupt before you get started, this is Scott's sweet spot. He loves to talk about gear and nuances and what things weigh and what kind of pack they go. I mean, this is his spot. So I may not get a word in edgewise. So let us know. What do you think is essential in a pack?
So is this when you disappear for the bathroom break right now?
Yeah, right now. Bathroom break. I'm going to dinner.
I posted a video in the middle of the early summer, I think the second week in August maybe, and it was the 10 essentials for backcountry travel and running. And I was out on an adventure with some friends, and you know, you post pictures to Instagram and they look amazing, but the story mm-hmm. isn't told when you're in the mountains and you post a single image. And what we discussed that day was, I need to tell more of the story about what we're carrying with us so that people don't end up seeing a picture on Instagram and going, okay, I'm going to go there right now. And they get out that way and get themselves in trouble because they're just underprepared for where they are. So the the gear that I listed in that video, there's certainly items in there that I feel, I think trail runners, we're terrible at going light on everything and just constantly being underprepared. And something I've said to people, especially at this time of year, now we're in November, when you're out for a training run, can you honestly say that if you were forced to stop in the middle of your run for 20 minutes, that you would be okay, that you would actually be comfortable, you wouldn't end up going hypothermic because you're running in terrible conditions in a t-shirt and shorts with no other gear with you? And mm-hmm. I mentioned right off the top there that I've broken my foot twice. I broke my foot both times on trail, and one of those times I had to get a helicopter evac, and I was fortunate that the second time was in Hawaii, was in a hot climate. The first time was actually while running with Max King and Jeff Rose, but it was in snow, and they were able to assist me in getting to a hospital. So I've got experience with how rapidly things can change, and you never think something is going to go wrong, but when it does, there's certain pieces that you'll be damn happy you're carrying if you've got them with you. And two of the main items really for me is one is a emergency bivy sack. They're super cheap, like under $20. And I did expedition adventure racing before ultra running, or as I was getting into ultra running. And in expedition racing, you sleep under the stars with the gear you're carrying with you. And in our first few expeditions, we were using space blankets. And it is, when you try to use a space blanket to actually sleep outside, you recognize the massive deficiencies of a space blanket within seconds. And we upgraded to emergency bivvies for later races. And in one race in particular, it was in Baja, Mexico. It was down to like 5 degrees at night. And me and one of my teammates shared an emergency bivvy. And it's basically a space blanket sleeping bag. And we were able to get 5 quality-ish hours of sleep that night, which would never have been possible with a space blanket. So an emergency bivy costs nothing, weighs very little. If you find yourself in an emergency situation, that is, I think, one of the critical pieces that's going to allow you to stay put and stay comfortable until help arrives. And then the big thing is, how do you communicate for help? Well, the majority of us are either not carrying your phones or going into terrain where there's no cell signal. And there are so many satellite GPS services available out there today, from InReach to Spot, where you can send an emergency signal to search and rescue. And you will know immediately that people know where you are and they're coming to get you. And that's the number one mistake that people make in the wilderness when they hurt themselves, is they don't have a way to communicate with people. They don't know when help will arrive. So they try to extract themselves and get themselves into trouble. I live in North Vancouver, and our North Shore mountains are notorious for search and rescue. It gets worse every year. And they've got, I think they had over 600 rescues on our local mountains right at my back door this year alone. So we see it all the time.
In 1 year?
The number one thing, it's crazy. Wow. Yeah. There's so many inexperienced people heading up into the mountains right now. And when people get lost or injured, the number one thing to do is to sit still, call for help, wait for help to arrive. And it's the mistake that people make all the time. So if you've got a way to message a GPS device, and you've got a way to stay warm, your emergency bivy, I also carry a fire kit and all these other items, then you know that you can stay out overnight if you need to, and search and rescue will come get you. If you don't have a way to stay warm and you don't have a way to communicate, you get into trouble really rapidly with not being able to stay confident and not moving.
Yeah, we used at the Tahoe 200 that spot device, and you could track the runner going all the way through. And I know on the video you demonstrated or held up a spot device, I believe. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a high risk out there as we're running. We could trip on something, hit your head on something. I mean, there's a lot of things, a broken foot, a lot of things can happen. And life is precious, and a spot device does not cost that much for that kind of insurance.
Yeah, and the annual subscription is the same cost as a pair of shoes.
Yeah, you probably have that much goo or just some trail food along the way on a lot of these runs. If you factor
well, that's just it. There's really no excuses when you boil it down and you look at the cost and the weight and the size. There are zero excuses. We can always make excuses, but they're not sure. Valid. And exactly, people, trail runners are going further and further out there. Ultra runners are always looking for the next great adventure. And when things go wrong, they can go wrong in a hurry.
Right. And like you said, when you're preparing for a run, for me, I'm standing in the kitchen and it's probably, 72 degrees or 68 or whatever, very comfortable, controlled by the thermostat. And I think, what do I need for this run? And I try
some socks.
Yeah.
Some shoes.
I just need a pair of shorts and my shirt and that's it. But how much would you give for an emergency bivy out there? I mean, not $20. You would start writing checks with many zeros and maybe some commas just because you think you're going to freeze to death. You will leverage 10 years of labor to make it through the night in some cases. So I think we need to, rethink this stay light, stay alive.
And in line with that, so I coach runners. I coach 24 athletes, but I also direct events. I direct 9 races. And on my alpine races, I have mandatory gear lists, and I've gone beyond space blankets. I don't think space blankets are sufficient, so I don't accept them as mandatory gear. I've conditioned the runners that are doing my alpine races, and mandatory gear is expected to be an emergency bivy. And that's, again, if you get injured, in my alpine races, if you get injured, someone will be there, but it's going to be a helicopter rescue, and it might take 5 or 6 hours. You might have to spend the night depending on weather conditions, and the emergency bivy is the one thing that's going to allow you to do that.
Well, I noticed you have some duct tape that you have rolled up in there. I mean, that's light and can be used for just about anything.
Exactly, right? There's, a bunch of smaller things in there that are just very versatile, duct tape being one of them. I've got an emergency kit that I kind of pieced together with a small headlamp and backup batteries, a fire kit, some first aid band-aids and antiseptic and whatnot. Very basic stuff. None of it really weighs that much. And when you're going out for a long adventure run, especially if you're talking 20, 30 or 40 miles, these are things that you really should be packing along with you.
One of the tips that I got from your video, that reminded me that I need to do is in your headlamp that you have in there, you reverse the battery so that it doesn't get bumped and get turned on and, use the battery up. I think that's also a really good tip.
It's funny. That's one of the ones that's got picked up the most in that video. The very first emergency kit that I set up and took with me, I was just replacing some stuff in there one day and I was like, what the heck is going on with this light? Why isn't it working? I put it in here with full batteries. And all I could guess was that I accidentally turned it on and drained the thing. And it was like, okay, well, if that's already happened, then flipping the batteries around, knowing that you're good to go. One very small thing that can make a huge difference is how terrible would it be to be carrying a headlamp and batteries only to have it not work when you pop it out.
Yeah. You had, bear bangers in there.
I've never even heard of a bear banger.
Yeah, but I like the way you described it. Tell us what the bear banger is.
So we do live in bear country here for sure, and a lot of runners out there do. I regularly see black bears in the summer. There are grizzlies on the coast. I haven't seen one personally on the coast, but on average, I come across 6 to 8 black bears a season. And I've only had 1 or 2 bears over the years that haven't just scattered as a good bear should when you start making some noise and talking to them. Yeah. And the ones that don't usually have cubs, or you can find yourself in a situation very rapidly where even a black bear can be very defensive. Bear bangers, they're cheap. They're under $30. And it's a launching pen. And then you can purchase the bear banger that goes on the end, but you can also purchase a flare. So it's multi-use. Having a flare for a rescue is another great item to have. And when you fire the firing pen, it shoots off the bear banger into the air. And I knew what bear bangers were, but I'd never used them because I'd never needed to. And I was out for a hike with my son back in August. And I was like, there's nothing around. I'm in the middle of nowhere. I'm going to fire this thing and see what happens right now. And so you let go and immediately it pops. And it's like a gunshot going off. Like my ear was ringing for a solid 10 minutes. And my son was crying for a solid 5 minutes.
Wow.
And then it shoots it into the air. And when it tops out, it pops a second time like another gunshot. So it basically sounds like back-to-back gunshots, and that certainly scatters most animals, and will usually an aggressive bear will send it away from you.
I wonder if that would work for a cougar. It's out there. I don't know.
Point it at them.
So, but then you also
fire
have
it right
some,
at the thing.
Some bear spray, and I've got a comment about bear spray. I don't know why we don't carry that around all over the place. It's home protection. I mean, to me, that looked...
Put it in your car, you mean?
Yeah, or yeah. Just put it in my holster that I carry along on my right leg.
Right there in your shirt pocket, right? I mean, it just says right off the bat, I don't enjoy strangers, and if you come too close, yeah, there may be consequences.
Maybe that's why I've been scraped. So you do some coaching. What are some of the things that you find that you need to help runners with the most? What's the most common problem?
I think the two most common problems are pacing and fueling. Even experienced runners that I've taken on board. So I have a coaching partner who I do this with. He's a PhD student studying the effects of altitude on elite endurance athletes, so very relevant to our sport. So he's the brain, so yeah. I'm just the face that talks a lot. And but definitely pacing and fueling are the two things I find even experienced people still struggle with sometimes. And fueling during the race itself, knowing that it's usually about a 200 to 250 calorie per hour necessity, and you don't get to skip hours. You don't get to just forego it for hours on end. So it's conditioning people through training to condition their stomach and their mind as to how to get those calories in and how to constantly solve the calorie issue while racing. And the second thing is pacing. I find that that most people start far too fast in any ultra race, and they suffer the consequences for it late. And guys are worse at this than girls. Typically, I can coach a female runner, and in a handful of races, we can get the pacing mostly figured out. And I've got some guys I coach where it's been like 14 months, and it's like we're getting close now. Just a couple more races where I need you to listen to me a little bit more, and you'll finally understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Hey, Gary, I've never been at the front of the pack racing, but we've interviewed some people that start up there and stay up there, and they were saying that. And the question is for you because you're up at the front. Do you do this? Have the same philosophy for yourself and elite runners by starting off too fast? I can't remember who we were talking to, and they said what they do is start off at a pretty good pace, and within the first 5, 6, 10 miles or whatever, if they feel good at that very fast pace, they know they're going to have a good day, and if they can maintain it, is that how you think, or do you also pace yourself from the start?
Well, it's funny because I've tried a couple of times to kind of go out a bit hotter than normal, and I've not had success with it whatsoever. The races I've had my best runs at are the ones where I've stayed conservative, believed in my fitness, and I'm talking especially as you get up into the 100-mile distance. I mean, you can really throw away your race in the first few hours of a 100-miler by just getting carried away. And a prime example is the first time I ran Hurt was 2010. I won it that year, and that was the year I took, I think, 16 minutes off of Jeff Rowe's then course record. And for the first 10 miles, I was as far back as ninth place. Tracy Garneau, who won the women's race, was five spots ahead of me for most of the first half of the first lap. And I just started off very conservatively, believed in what I was doing. And by the, I think it was mile 30 or 35, I was in the lead, and I didn't give it up after that. And I've run Hurt, like I mentioned, four times now. And I've experimented a little bit with trying to be a bit less conservative on the first lap. And my fifth lap split, the worst split I've ever had by far, by almost an hour, on the final 20 miles. And this is one of those great races where you can really look at the data afterwards and see specifically, well, you're doing five of the same laps. This is your fade rate from start to finish. The one year I went out faster than I typically would, my last lap was an hour slower than what it usually was. And in my best runs at Hurt, I've done the first four laps in under 4 hours, and my fifth lap has been exactly 4 hours and 31 minutes both times. So I've managed to find the pacing and stick with it. So I call it your fade rate, and I've kept my fade rate very respectable throughout, because you're going to fade as the race unfolds no matter what. but it's a matter of keeping that fade rate respectable, 5, 10, 15%, not 25, 30%, which is what happens when you're giving too much too early.
Hmm. So what do you use to monitor? Do you use heart rate monitor? Do you use heart rate to do it? Your breathing? What's your tool and, you know, bio indicator or biomarker?
Yeah, great question. And I actually, so I've had to get some of my runners to use heart rate to really get them to look at the data afterwards and go, no, see, this is what I'm talking about. You're still going a bit too fast here. And I would use heart rate early on to determine this, but it's run by feel. I've got enough experience now that I can honestly assess what I'm pacing at. And the way I describe it to people is when I start a race, it's not accurate to say that I don't think I'm going too fast because you're amped. The race is starting. It's a race. Everybody's there. There's a lot going on. If I say to myself, I don't think I'm going too fast, it probably means I'm actually still going too fast. What I really need the sensation to be is I'm going too slow. And those are two very different analysis of how you're feeling. So when I can look at it and go, wow, I feel like I'm going too slow right now, you know, I'm hanging back and doing a minute a mile slower than the guys that I'm trying to compete against, that's me knowing that I'm starting a smart race.
Yeah, that takes a lot of discipline and really to believe in your plan when you see the guys that you expect to beat that are now you know, 5 minutes ahead of you at the aid station. You're thinking, oh man, you know, am I making a mistake? Am I going to reel them back in?
Yeah, and you know, one of the runners that really displayed this in spades in 2016 was Jeff Browning, and he showed it at the end of 2014 at UTMF. He finished third, but he was way the heck back at the halfway mark and just outpaced everybody over the last 30 miles because he knows. He's done so many of these races. He knows how to pace. He's a prime example of an experienced 100-mile runner who has the confidence in what he's doing and knows that he's going to be faster than the people around him over the last 20 and 30 miles by being slower than the people around him over the first 20 to 30 miles.
I've mentioned this before, but I've kind of take the end of the race and I think as I'm at mile 5 and I'm running this pace, would I be happy with this pace at 95? And of course I'd be elated if I was moving at this pace at 95. So with that, I just allow myself to go ahead and start slow and go easy that, you know, it's a race from start to finish, just not your first 20 miles.
And the funny thing is, out of everybody I've coached, I've never, ever had a single person come back to me and say, well, that didn't work, or, you know, I don't agree with you on that. Once they get it, they're like, okay, yeah, this definitely, I was way faster closing that race than I've ever been before because I had legs from taking it easy early on.
Yeah, that pays big, big dividends, big time. Because you can go pretty slow when you're slogging it out, trying to just finish it up.
Yeah, exactly. The disparity in speeds at the end versus someone who has legs and someone who doesn't is dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Gary, you're up there in Vancouver, British Columbia. You say you do some race directing. Tell us about some of the running and trails in Vancouver and maybe some of the races that you direct up there.
Yeah,
get us excited about Canada.
Yeah, Canada's a good spot. We got some pretty great races up this way. So Vancouver, and then you've got two bridges that depart Vancouver, and I'm in North Vancouver. It's funny. It's two different cities, and those of us who live in North Vancouver are passionate about North Vancouver versus Vancouver, but they're right next to each other, and they're pretty much the same thing. North Vancouver, out my back door, within a mile, I've got access to trails that literally go on for there's hundreds of kilometers of trail here in North Vancouver, and I can step on an access point in under a mile from my door that gets me out there all day long. So we're spoiled in the fact that we've got amazing trail access. We've got amazing trail societies, people that oversee and develop the trails, trail maintenance, trail upkeep, all the way through the coast here in British Columbia. And I can go out in North Vancouver and legitimately have a mountain experience, a wild and burly trail out in nowhere where you won't see anybody, and I can finish it up and come down and have world-class sushi and coffee in the afternoon and not even believe the contrast over what I've just experienced. And a prime example, James Verner from Rain Shadow Running, he came up a couple of years ago. There's this trail right here in North Vancouver called the Howe Sound Crest Trail. It's under 19 miles. It has 6,500 feet of climbing, 9,500 feet of descent. And James came up and I took him along that trail and he just was blown away. He said, I've never seen anything like this so close to a major city before. And that's what we have here that you don't get in a lot of other centers. I know out of Seattle, there's phenomenal running, but typically it's 45 to 60 minutes one way to get to that area. And for us, it is literally out our back door. When I draw a circumference over North Vancouver that includes Squamish and Whistler and Port Moody, you're now talking a drive time of less than 90 minutes. From North Vancouver to Whistler is less than 90 minutes. And Squamish is a huge trail town. Again, hundreds of kilometers of trail. And Whistler the same. So within 90 minutes drive, I truly stand by the statement that we've got more trails than you could ever get a chance to truly explore by living here, meaning you just never tire, you never bore of what we have because we're spoiled with the access that we've got here on the coast. So the races I direct. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No. That's my next question. Tell me about the race. It really wasn't my next question, but that's a better question than mine, and I want to take credit for it.
Perfect.
So tell us about your races.
So I direct 9 events now. The first event, it was the 5th anniversary this year, is the Squamish 50. We've grown the Squamish 50 over 5 years to become one of the largest trail races in Canada, the largest ultra-distance trail weekend in Canada, and the largest non-relay-based trail run in Canada. We had over 1,200 people sign up in 2016 from 18 countries, 35 states, 10 Canadian provinces and territories. So that's the 5th year this year for that race, and that was what set myself and my co-race director, Jeff Langford, up for starting a race series. The race series is called the Coast Mountain Trail Series. We've got 6 races in that banner, and the distances range from 8 kilometers up to 50 kilometers. So it's kind of, it's an entry-level distance where a lot of people can tackle it, but we make our races very technical and very difficult. So even the 8-kilometer race distance still has, I think, 1,500 or 1,700 feet of climbing in it. So they're kind of graduate-level, shorter races that set people up nicely to get into ultra-distance events. What I've really taken pride in the last few years is I've managed to bring a couple of alpine races to life. One in Squamish, a separate race to the Squamish 50 called Sky Pilot, which is atop the Sea to Sky gondola. And we basically get up over 5,000 feet, which here on the coast from sea level is quite high, exposed dramatic rock faces and views on a clear day, just almost looks like a mini version of the Alps. And this year in September, I got a race off the ground in Whistler, a 12K, a 25K, and a 50K. And it's called the Whistler Alpine Meadows, or WAM for short. So we worked in some good old classic WAM 80s memorabilia into our prizing. and that race in particular, the ultra, it's actually 55K. I called it 50 just to be cruel to people. And the 55K has over 11,000 feet of climbing and descent and gets up into a magnificent, you run to a glacier and back. I mean, I think that sums it all up right there. You run from the village of Whistler up to a glacier and back. And we launched this year, we sold out. And how I really know we did something special was almost every runner that ran the race is asking for early entry to next year because they're worried that it's going to sell out before they can register once we launch in December.
Oh, wow. You've struck a chord. Where do you find these races to sign up? Where's the best place to check it out and get on your list?
Actually, the easiest link is, so you mentioned my run blog site, GaryRobbinsRun.com. But if you actually go to GaryRobbins.ca, that's my landing page, which lists all of my events and my blog and everything on there. So it links to each of the individual races. The other event that I've been really happy to work on is Red Bull 400. Have you guys heard of that one before?
No. Tell us.
So there's some fun YouTube clips. So once we're done, look up Red Bull 400. It is a 400 meter long race, the steepest race in the world. And it debuted in Europe. And what they do is you run up the side of an Olympic ski hill, ski jump to the very top of the Olympic ski jump at the top. Yeah. So it's 400 meters long. And you get almost 1,000 feet of climbing, and it's just nutty the grade that you get up to. And I was able to bring that one to life in Whistler here in Canada 2 years ago. This will be our 3rd year going into next year. And it's a super fun race because anybody can finish the race in under 15 minutes. So anybody can partake, and everything is right in front of you. You can watch everybody racing right in front of you while you've done your race and you're kind of enjoying a beer in the beer gardens.
That's very, very cool. You know, one of the things that we've been kicking around a little bit with AJW is kind of doing a spinoff on the book. We're not writing a book, but Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. And yep. And there's so many little things that add up to make this big change. I mean, yeah. Trail running seems ever present, especially for us because that's what we do. But there are a number of things that lead up to that make it happen. And I think one of the things that contributes are your races, the 8K and the 400, you know, meter dash up that thing, and a number of races that welcome non-ultra distant people to the sport, and they'll graduate as they wish and maybe find the sweet spot is the 10K. And I would run a lot of 10Ks if I was fast. I just have to make things long because I'm slow. And so I think I think one of the things you're doing is very, very important in adding to that tipping point that has brought trail to so many people that now enjoy it.
And thank you. And that was kind of where I stepped back after we had success with the Squamish 50 in the first year, was when we decided to build out a series. I didn't want to just build out an ultra series. I wanted to build races that I thought would be cool as a non-ultra runner that would, again, like you just said, I wanted to set up almost like a tiered, like a, you know, set up a staircase. If you want to do ultras, then we've got a whole set of races that you can do to show yourself the graduation process to line up and do ultras, and exactly like you said, find the distance that speaks to you the most.
Hey, before we Scott and I usually do repeats on this hill. We're on a trail run, right? So I don't know if we're going to scrape you here or not, Robbins. We may drop you here, but I want to talk a little bit about this adventure running and racing and just finding a colleague, a Jared Campbell, and saying, "Hey, let's go do that." That really inspires me and makes me feel like, you know, we run a lot so that we can put a bib on and go race, but there's more to it than just bibbing up. There are just, let's go find a couple of friends for safety and plan well, and let's go out and have an adventure.
100%, and that's a big conversation I have with...
Yeah,
that's a big conversation I have with people I coach. You get burned out sometimes on the running and putting on the bib, and we've really got to step back and appreciate the fitness that we get from what we do and apply it elsewhere other than just lining up for races and doing these wonderful adventures. Year over year, for me, the absolute highlights of the year are, race results are up there, but typically it's the adventure runs that I've gotten out to do. You know, running around Mount St. Helens, running around Rainier, running adventure runs in another province, state, territory, and getting out there and doing it with friends and sharing a very special experience with a group of people that you really enjoy being with.
Yeah. And I like all of that. And especially the fact that it's a good excuse to go buy some gear. And that, because if you're going to go out and fit, you need some different stuff. You need a new pack. You need that compass and the map. You may need a watch that has some GPS points in it. You need stuff.
So are you on Amazon buying stuff? Is that what's happening? I can see that.
I've signed up for two of your races is what I've done. and now you coach. And now you coach me as well. You didn't realize that.
Perfect.
Hey Gary, what's on your bucket list as far as an adventure run with some friends? Do you have any destinations on your bucket list that you want to go do?
Yeah, it's I've been very fortunate over the last couple of years to start ticking some of these items off. You know, everybody's got the rim to rim to rim. I was lucky to do that with a great group of friends early a year and a half ago now. The couple of things at the top of my bucket list right now, one of them is Nolan's 14s. So the Nolan's 14ers, which is the route in Colorado. There's only been a handful of finishers, I think a dozen, that have accomplished it. There's another route in the UK called Bob Graham Round. That's another one that speaks to me. And then locally, I've had the opportunity to run around a lot of the volcanoes and stuff that are in the area here, just down in Washington State, not too far of a drive. The big ones that are speaking to me right now are the get out of town ones. Like I said, like the Nolan's 14ers for sure is one that I would really love to make happen. If I don't luck out in the Hard Rock Lottery this year, that's going to be right at the top of the list.
Would you do the Nolan's 14 solo, or would you take a pal?
Well, Jared and I have already had a discussion, and he went to do Nolan's in the opposite direction this year, but had some stomach issues and had to drop. And he and I are currently talking about, like I said, if the lottery doesn't pan out, possibly teaming up to do that one together. And then Jared said he's got a great training route for Nolan's 14ers. It's the Utah 13ers, and he thinks that should be done 2 weeks before.
2 weeks? You guys recover quick.
I'll just be trying to keep up.
Well, that's all good stuff. And we really appreciate you joining us on this podcast and talking through some of this. Do you have room left now that I'm already, you're coaching me? Is there room left for anybody else? Are you open for clients?
We have a wait list right now for clients. We did just actually roll in 3 new people. So there has been some movement on the wait list. My PhD coaching partner has freed up a little bit of his time. So we've just added a few people. So our wait list is fairly shallow right now. So the website is ridgelineathletics.com. You can check it out. The great thing for American runners, it's in Canadian dollars. So it's like super score of a deal right now. So if you fill out an application on there, we can let you know what we're looking at time-wise.
Good. Same benefit with race entry fees, too? Are we talking a good exchange for Canadian?
That's right. Maybe Squamish is the best deal around.
Yeah.
Absolutely, it is. All in Canadian dollars. I think with the exchange currently, our Squamish 50-miler will be about $95 yet again. So still under $100 for the Squamish 50-miler.
Well, that's good stuff. Hey, in the future, we'd like to get you on again, but I'm interested in talking a little bit about some altitude training and some of the things that you guys are finding out over there in your laboratory and using your clients as guinea pigs, really, is what you're doing. You're testing your theory. You're testing your theories and you're proving them out.
Absolutely. Yeah, actually. So Eric Carter is his name, and he's quite an accomplished athlete himself. He has the FKT for ascending and descending Mount Rainier. He's a ski mountaineer athlete is his primary focus. So he's got the FKT on the Rainier up and down, and he's just collecting his data right now on that. So he'll have something to present later next year.
My goodness, what is it about, like you opened up the podcast with discussing that people that run the Barkley, there's a lot of smart people doing it, PhDs, well-accomplished engineers, et cetera, that are doing it. So it always intrigues me that the people that are most accomplished with sheepskins hanging on their wall are also putting on a pair of gaiters and nailing it on Saturday.
I think it's honoring the process, right? It's those people that know that you have to take a long-term approach, and if you stick with it, you can reap the benefits of putting in the time.
Good stuff. Gary Robbins, athlete, adventure runner, coach, race director, and overall good guy. And we're not going to scrape him. No way.
No way.
So thanks for joining us. Scott has all of these items. I see him. He has a full page of notes. So he'll be linking race places and ways to get a hold of you to sign up for coaching, etc. He's good with that. So we thank you for joining us today.
Guys, thank you so much for having me. I know this has been a long-term approach for us to make this happen, so I'm glad we finally nailed down the time where we could all connect.
Okay, now I'll hit record because that was just the warm-up. You didn't know we do a trial to qualify you. We qualified you, and now we're ready to start. Welcome to another edition of
Trail. I can't wait to start telling my stories.
Hey, Gary, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks, guys. Take care.
You go out and run. Oh, wait,